Brexit in motion, the fate of nuclear power, and a sudden and unexpected rush to Medicaid. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, March 29th. I'm glad you could be here with us today. Brexit has begun. Britain today began the formal process of ending its more than 40-year membership in the European Union. Next up, 2 years of wrangling as the UK negotiates the terms of its departure. Many British industries face an uncertain future, including one of the most successful, the big financial hub in the British capital known as The City. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
This martial music is often played at civic ceremonies in the city. Quite fitting, since this financial centre has crushed all its continental rivals. But among these city workers, on their lunch break, there's rather less confidence as Brexit looms.
Pretty anxious because it's going to affect me directly. I might be going downhill, so it's going to be a little bit of a problem because, you know, like, you don't get a lot of opportunities anymore and stuff like that. So, yeah, that's my concern.
Are you nervous that London could suffer as a financial centre?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly could. There's been talk about lots of big businesses preparing to move out.
Up to 100,000 jobs could go, according to one estimate. Mushtaba Rahman of the Eurasia Group won't put figures on it, but he says if London doesn't retain its unfettered access to the EU market, it could be grim. How grim? Are we talking about massive job losses, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars worth of business being lost?
I think so. In a worst-case scenario, you're talking about a very significant readjustment and there will be economic pain.
Yes, what's going on? Any liquid credit bank, please?
Since the financial crisis, many Brits have disparaged the city as a citadel of greed. But financial services are crucial for Britain. They employ more than 2 million people and, says city spokesman Gary Kampkin, pay a lot of tax.
It's the largest tax-paying industry in the UK. It pays enough tax to, in effect, fund the Department for Education.
And he says selling services like brokerage and insurance abroad is the UK's biggest exporter.
And in terms of export surplus, it's more than most of the other sectors combined. So it really does have a very important footprint for the United Kingdom.
60% of its exports go to the EU through an arrangement called passporting that comes with EU membership. The city wants to keep most of the benefits of that passport after Brexit, but the EU's chief negotiator, Frenchman Michel Barnier, doesn't sound amenable.
Being a member of the European Union comes with rights and benefits. Third countries can never have the same rights and benefits.
The big investment banks based in London fear they may lose access to mainland Europe. Goldman Sachs is shifting hundreds of staff from London to a continental financial centre. Morgan Stanley could move up to 1,000 jobs. But city spokesman Gary Kampkin is undaunted.
We see no reason why London cannot continue to be not just the world's leading global financial centre, along with New York, but also Europe's financial centre.
He says Europe needs London's huge pools of international capital. Others are even more dismissive of any threat from Brexit.
Ratesetters cut out the middleman and get better returns on their money. Search Ratesetter and make today pay.
This online peer-to-peer lending firm set up in the city just after the financial crisis. So far, it's clocked up more than $2 billion worth of business. The firm's John Battersby says, Brexit, bring it on.
We don't think that we'll be held back by a lack of passporting or whatever other things you want to talk about. I think it comes down to opportunities, taking advantage of them, and that comes down to drive, determination, entrepreneurial spirit.
That may be a Brit putting on a brave face, but there's no doubt the culture of the city is well suited to all the uncertainties of Brexit, as this city worker makes clear.
I'm actually looking forward to it personally. I like market volatility, so I'm hoping it does cause some volatility and I can get some good investments.
In the city, Europe's top financial centre, for now, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, market volatility. Also, the pound weakened. All the market details when we do the numbers. One of the biggest names in nuclear energy around the globe has just declared Chapter 11. Westinghouse has built or helped build half the nuclear reactors in the entire world, but now it is going bankrupt. This raises big questions about atomic energy and how much of a place it has in the U.S. energy mix. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Westinghouse has been helping to build nuclear reactors in Georgia and South Carolina, but they're overdue and some $5 billion over budget. They're the first new reactors in years, and U.S. industry just wasn't geared up for it, says Jesse Jenkins at the MIT Energy Initiative.
We have an atrophied supply chain for manufacturing and construction of nuclear components in the United States. That's a result of not having built any new nuclear reactors for several decades. So Westinghouse had to really rebuild from scratch almost.
On top of that are costs imposed from Washington. Nuclear is carbon-free, but it doesn't get the subsidies wind and solar energy get. Instead, it gets more regulations and safety standards, especially after the meltdown at Fukushima in Japan 6 years ago raised new fears. Consultant Luke Barrett is a former nuclear regulator.
The regulatory requirements are tighter and tighter and tighter all the time post-Fukushima. Generally, society, you know, doesn't want to accept hardly any risk at all, so that tends to drive up costs.
Meantime, the market competition has undercut nuclear. We're talking about natural gas, which is cheap and plenty. Morningstar analyst Charles Fishman considers gas a much better bet.
There's a less risk, which investors like, in building a natural gas plant, and lower capital costs. The negative of a gas plant used to be the higher cost of natural gas, and we're just not seeing that right now.
A decade ago, the experts predicted a nuclear renaissance in America. Now, no new projects are expected anytime soon. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We're still sifting through the fallout of Republicans' failure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act last week. One unexpected consequence, it's got some states who were once against Medicaid expansion now thinking about whether they should, in fact, get with the program. Just yesterday, the Kansas legislature, yes, super red Kansas, sent the governor a bill to do just that. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports that as many as 19 states might be reevaluating their options.
By ditching the Trump care bill, Congress actually did pro-Medicaid advocates in Kansas a favor.
What happened last week took an argument away from those who were against expansion.
Tom Bell heads up the Kansas Hospital Association.
They couldn't say anymore, Congress is on the verge of repealing Medicaid expansion, so why should we do anything?
Kansas could become the first state under the Trump administration to expand Medicaid. Holdouts continue to have a hard decision: expand their programs and get nearly all of the costs covered, or leave potentially billions on the table. And now the new administration has signaled it's okay with states imposing things like work requirements and co-pays. Even in hardline states like Alabama, all of this gives advocates ammunition. Dane Howard is at the Alabama Hospital Association.
The fact that Kansas, being a Republican state, is moving forward, and now we have a secretary at HHS that might be a little bit more accommodating, so that would re-energize us a little bit.
Opposition will remain fierce. Lawmakers worry states will have to spend more money on Medicaid when they already think Medicaid's too expensive. But Harvard economist Mike Chernew says the economics of this are easy.
If someone's offering to give you money, take the money.
Chernew says the Medicaid dollars will prop up hospitals, probably reduce some state spending, and ultimately grow the economy. The holdout states are already paying federal taxes that fund the expanded Medicaid programs. Not much point in that, says Chernew. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
From uncertain health markets to uncertain housing markets, low-income housing development is already a pretty speculative business. But the election of President Trump has added even more uncertainty. Over the past 30 years, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit program has created millions of units of affordable housing across the country. But with corporate tax reform on the horizon, investors are looking at lower tax bills overall, and that makes a tax credit for building low-income housing much less appealing. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
It's a frigid 30 degrees out, but construction at Portner Flats Apartments in Washington, D.C. is moving full speed ahead.
There'll be 96 units here, all of them financed with the low-income housing tax credit program.
Bill Whitman is a partner with Somerset Development, which owns this building. In a city where the cost of rent is rising exponentially, this project will be reserved for families making below AMI, or the area median income. Compare that with another construction site across the street.
The average rents in that building are expected to be $5.38 a square foot, whereas the rents for the affordable units in this project will be $1.75 a square foot.
Did you catch that? These apartments will be rented more than three times below the market rate. This is possible because the credits awarded to investors allow a dollar-for-dollar credit against their federal taxes in exchange for funding affordable housing. Without the credits, Whitman says regular people could never afford to live here.
The low-income housing tax credit program is critical, is essential. It's the but-for in projects like this. Without it, this doesn't happen.
But if you cut corporate tax rates from 35% down to 20 or 15, as President Trump wants to do, you also cut the demand for a credit.
We've already seen the prospect of tax reform have a meaningful impact on the price that investors are willing to pay.
Paul Weissman directs affordable housing lending for the Hunt Mortgage Group. He says investors are already valuing credits 15 to 20% lower, and if you factor in rising interest rates, which makes lending even more costly, the overall impact
is potentially much more because you have projects that are no longer viable that before were viable.
Currently, some 100,000 new units of affordable housing come onto the market nationally each year. Unfortunately, it's nowhere near enough, says David Godshalk of Telesis.
The challenge is that this is coming at a time when demand for affordable housing, particularly demand for housing for very low-income families, is growing.
Telesis is a developer specializing in affordable housing projects in urban areas. Since the Great Recession, Godshalk says rents have risen much faster than incomes, creating a supply shortage of around 4 million units.
As an example, if we build 100,000 units of tax credit housing every year, even if we were to double that, we could build at that pace for the next 20 years and still not fill the current gap.
If tax credit values tank, that means projects would need to find some kind of gap financing. Another solution is just to sell more credits.
If we would put more credit into the marketplace, more of those projects could be built.
Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell and Republican Orrin Hatch have drafted a legislative solution called the Affordable Housing Credit Improvement Act, which aims to expand funding for the tax credit program by 50%, or perhaps less.
Maybe if we're out there on the Senate floor and somebody said, oh, how about 30, and we could get it done, you know, we might end up at a different point. But I definitely think you can justify the demand for this.
Cantwell says the act would create or preserve around 1.3 million affordable homes over 10 years and build another 400,000 more than is possible under the current program. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the rumors of Moore's Law death stretch back 25 years.
But chip makers aren't going to let the pesky little laws of physics get in the way of progress. First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 42 points, 0.2% to close at 20,659. The NASDAQ gained 22 points, 0.3% to close at 5,897. And the S&P 500 gained 2 points, that is 0.1% to close at 2,361. American Express has taken aim again at JPMorgan Chase's popular Sapphire Reserve card by increasing points for its Platinum card customers. Not working out just yet, Amex shed 0.5%. The Library of Congress has selected NWA's album Straight Outta Compton for its registration in recognition of its artistic and cultural significance. Live Nation, a promotion and ticketing company, picked up 0.2%. Pandora gained just over 0.1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.38%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Tell a friend about a podcast you think they're going to love. Right now, think of somebody you care about. What podcast do you think they would really enjoy listening to?
And once you've got it in your head, go do this in real life. Or you could do it on social media. If they don't know how to listen to a podcast, show them how to download one. And please tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod. That's T-R-Y-P-O-D. POD. And thank you for spreading the word.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Privacy on the internet has been a growing conversation in the past few years. Targeted ads, high-profile hacks, and more personal data collection all have people thinking about how to shield their activities online. That practice could really take off because of a vote this week in Congress that clears the way for internet providers to use and sell their customers' online activity. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains.
VPN stands for Virtual Private Network. What does one do? Well, according to one service's website,
we create an encrypted tunnel so that nobody can spy on you.
Basically, you connect to the service, it hides your information, so outsiders can't tell who or where you are while you're online. Vikram Fatok is CEO of independent security tester NSS Labs. He says it's not about hiding anything illegal.
It's about if you're ordering groceries, do you really want your carrier to know?
And make money off it. Interest in online privacy has increased. Fatok says it's likely big internet companies like Google will move to incorporate more encryption in their browsers, but that could take years.
In the short run, I do expect that the VPN providers will start competing and will start advertising and really will try to get more customers to use their services.
While there are some free VPNs, most charge. Ted Kim is CEO of Private Internet Access, whose video I played earlier. Their VPN rates begin at a few dollars a month. The company has taken out ads in the New York Times and Washington Post, but Kim says it's not just about making money.
We believe in internet freedom. We believe in personal privacy. You know, if there is an uptick in business for us, it's not necessarily the reason why we would want something like that.
Still, the potential for business is there. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about you and your money. After all, these wild political developments are rocking markets, whether it is a President Trump tweet, the Brexit fallout, elections in Europe, change in China, all of that can translate right into your retirement savings. So we thought we would ask some professionals what they advise in times like these. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that one.
When the stock market is up or down, folks like Bridget Madrian get hit up by everyone, friends, family. They want to know, how am I supposed to invest now?
The advice today I would give them is the same as the advice that I would give them a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, which is to invest in a well-diversified portfolio and then don't pay a whole awful lot of attention to it.
She's a Harvard behavioral economist focused on investing behavior, which means she knows all the ways our emotions can steer us astray.
That's what makes us human. We can get caught up in our feelings and let them drive our decisions.
That's why it's hard to stay the course when headlines pop up about world events moving markets.
That's where we put on our psychologist hat.
Financial planner Douglas Bonaparte.
When there are volatile times, we're there to be counselors and coaches for our clients.
The Smart Plan is less about swashbuckling moves through choppy markets and more about discipline. In other words, it's super boring. Financial planner Dave O'Brien.
The market's going to go up and down over time. You have to stick with your target allocation. And I know that doesn't sound exciting, but that's the best dose of medicine for your portfolio.
Bottom line, when something in the news sends markets way up or way down, take a deep breath and think back to a calm day when you settled on a savings and investment plan for the long term. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Now for a little nerd time with Molly Wood. Let's start with a refresher on something called Moore's Law. More than half a century ago, Intel co-founder Gordon Moore predicted that essentially processor power would increase exponentially over time. It's a little more complicated than that, but for decades, the rule has pretty much held true, and it's led to faster and cheaper computing power. That enables supercomputer-like phones in our pockets, self-driving cars, smart refrigerators, stuff like that. But there is a popular belief these days that chip makers just won't be able to keep up with Moore's Law anymore. For more on Moore, we've got Intel's Stacy Smith on the line. He's Executive Vice President of Manufacturing Operations and Sales. Stacy, how are you?
I'm great. It's great to be here with you today.
So you are in San Francisco, as I understand it, talking about, of all things, Moore's Law. I have heard rumors that Moore's Law may have been killed off. But you say not so fast, right?
No, not so fast. You know, the rumors of Moore's Law death stretch back 25 years. And what happens is the smart technologists figure out ways to continue to advance it and solve problems that, you know, they had supposed were insurmountable. And the beauty of that for us is that it lets us bring down costs and bring more capable products to the marketplace year in, year out.
And what has, for those who have not followed this story arc, what is Moore's Law playing out over time meant for Intel's business in particular as you keep building computer chips?
Yeah, it's huge. It is it's the economic law that really drives our business. And frankly, it's not just huge for us. It's huge for the industry and the economy at large. Specifically for us, what it means is that every generation we can bring out new capabilities that enable people to, you know, have new usage models like immersive virtual reality, or to solve the big problems of the world by putting, you know, supercomputers to work on mapping the genome, those kinds of things. And we can do it at a lower cost and more capability.
At what point does physics start to get in the way? I know that, that you know, you've already had to cross what seemed like impassable barriers to keep making transistors smaller and more powerful. How long can that go on?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was in the factories back, you know, in 1990, so 25 years ago, and that was the point at which the line that we were trying to scribe on a wafer was more narrow than the wavelength of light, and we used something called lithography to do that. So it was actually, think of it as almost a photo process, and that was seen as an insurmountable technology barrier. There's just no way the industry could progress past the wavelength of light, and it wasn't even a speed bump. The reality is that the smart men and women that work in these factories and technology development, they find ways to use x-rays. They find ways to bend light by putting it through water, and they continue to solve these problems.
What does this mean for what does this conversation mean for the actual physical creation of these transistors? Like, are we talking about the tiniest robots building the tiniest chips?
We have highly automated factories. I wouldn't say it's robots building chips. You know, each factory that we build has thousands of people. The work that they do is very different than what they used to do. It's moved from, you know, physically touching the wafer to being engineers to make sure that the equipment that's manufacturing the products is doing that with a high level of precision. I think the big impact of Moore's Law, though, is it just that basic model of being able to double the capability every year, or bring the cost down every year, or every 2 years, excuse me, is just a fundamental driver. I shared some, if I can digress a second, I shared some fun data that we had pulled up that said if other industries progressed at the same kind of doubling of capabilities every 2 years that Moore's Law had, and if you applied the same metric to something like gas mileage, it says you could drive to the sun from the earth on a single gallon of gas. You could drive that, you know, distance with a single gallon of gas. It's just a phenomenal driver of our business and the economy.
So how much, I mean, it seems like every day we have some new vision, whether it's, you know, the virtual reality, completely immersive virtual reality, self-driving cars, missions to Mars. How much of that actually depends on you being successful in extending the life of Moore's Law?
Yeah, all of it.
All of it.
You know, if we stopped being able to advance the capabilities of computers, we would stop advancing our capability to solve some of these problems. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Stacy Smith from Intel, thank you so much.
It's great talking to you. Thank you.
This final note before we go, the United Airlines leggings story has more legs than I thought it would. Crickets. Anyway, other companies are still finding ways to throw shade at United after it refused to allow two teenage girls on a flight because they were traveling on an employee travel pass and their leggings violated the dress code for those passes. Today's snark comes from Puma, which tweeted to its 1.5 million followers that you can bring any United ticket into a U.S. Puma store and get a 20% discount on leggings. Ouch. Also, I did not even know that Puma made leggings, so I guess that worked. All right, we got to go, but I just wanted to let you know there's a new episode of the Corner Office podcast from Marketplace out today. This time, Kai went back into the archives for his interview with noted fashion icon Donna Karan. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer this program for us. I'm Molly Wood. We'll be back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.